incompatible with some of his other assumptions. That flaw became apparent in a mathematical presentation of the argument, whereas mutually incompatible assumptions can coexist indefinitely in an imprecise verbal presentation. Systematic analysis of carefully defined terms and the systematic testing of theories against empirical evidence are all part of a scientific study of any subject. Clearly, economics has advanced in this direction in the centuries since its beginnings. However, economics is scientific only in the sense of having some of the procedures of science, but the inability to conduct controlled experiments prevents its theories from having the precision and repeatability often associated with science. On the other hand, there are other fields with a recognized scientific basis which also do not permit controlled experiments, astronomy being one and meteorology being another. Moreover, there are different degrees of precision among these fields. In astronomy, for example, the time when eclipses will occur can be predicted to the second, even centuries ahead of time, while meteorologists have a high error rate when forecasting the weather a week ahead. Although no one questions the scientific principles of physics on which weather forecasting is based, the uncertainty as to how the numerous combinations of factors will come together at a particular place on a particular day makes forecasting a particular event that day much more hazardous than predicting how those factors will interact if they come together. Presumably, if a meteorologist knew in advance just when a warm and moisture-laden air mass moving up from the Gulf of Mexico would encounter a cold and dry air mass moving down from Canada, that meteorologist would be able to predict rain or snow in St. Louis to a certainty, since that would be nothing more than the application of the principles of physics to these particular circumstances. It is not those principles which are uncertain, but all the variables whose behavior will determine which of those principles will apply at a particular place at a particular time. What is scientifically known is that the collision of cold, dry air and warm, moist air does not produce sunny and calm days. What is unknown is whether these particular air masses will arrive in St. Louis at the same time, or pass over it in succession, or miss it completely. That is where statistical probabilities are calculated as to whether they will continue moving at their present speeds and without changing direction. In principle, economics is much like meteorology. There is no example in recorded history in which a government increased the money supply tenfold in 1 year without prices going up, nor does anyone expect that there ever will be. The effects of price controls in creating shortages, black markets, product quality decline, and a reduction in auxiliary services have likewise been remarkably similar, whether in the Roman Empire under Diocletian, in Paris during the French Revolution, or in the New York housing market under rent control today. Nor has there been any fundamental difference whether the price being controlled was that of housing, food, or medical care. Controversies among economists make news, but that does not mean that there are no established principles in this field, any more than controversies among scientists mean that there is no such thing as established principles of chemistry or physics. In both cases, these controversies seldom involve predicting what would happen under given circumstances, but forecasting what will in fact happen in circumstances that cannot be completely foreseen. In short, these controversies usually do not involve disagreement about fundamental principles of the field, but about how all the trends and conditions will come together to determine which of those principles will apply or predominate in a particular set of circumstances. Among the many objections made against economics have been claims that it is simplistic, or that it assumes too much self-interested and materialistic rationality, or that the assumptions behind its analyses and predictions are not a true depiction of the real world. Implicit in the term simplistic is that a particular explanation is not just simple, but too simple. That only raises the question, too simple for what? If the facts consistently turn out the way the explanation predicts, then it has obviously not been too simple for its purpose, especially if the facts do not turn out the way a more complicated or more plausible-sounding explanation predicts. In short, Whether or not any given explanation is too simple is an empirical question that cannot be decided in advance by how plausible, complex, or nuanced an explanation seems on the face of it, but can only be determined after examining hard evidence on how well its predictions turn out. A related attempt to determine the validity of a theory by how plausible it looks, rather than how well it performs when put to the test, is the criticism that economic analysis depicts people as thinking or acting in a way that most people do not think or act. But economics is ultimately about systemic results, not personal intentions. Economists on opposite ends of the ideological spectrum have understood this. Karl Marx said that capitalists lower their prices when technological advances lower their costs of production, not because they want to, but because market competition forces them to. Adam Smith likewise said that the benefits of a competitive market economy are no part of capitalists' intentions. As Marx's collaborator Engels said, what each individual wills is obstructed by everyone else, and what emerges is something that no one willed. It is what emerges that economics tries to predict, and its success or failure is measured by that, not by how plausible its analysis looks at the outset. Personal bias is another fundamental question that has long been raised about economics and its claim to scientific status. J.A. Schumpeter, whose massive History of Economic Analysis, published in 1954, remains unequaled for its combination of breadth and depth, dealt with the much-discussed question of the effect of personal bias on economic analysis. He found ideological bias common among economists, ranging from Adam Smith to Karl Marx. But what he also concluded was how little effect these biases had on these economists' analytical work, which can be separated out from their ideological comments or advocacies. In a scholarly journal article as well, Schumpeter singled out Adam Smith in particular. In Adam Smith's case, the interesting thing is not indeed the absence, but the harmlessness of ideological bias. Smith's unrelievedly negative picture of businessmen was, to Schumpeter, an ideological bias deriving from Smith's background in a family which did not belong to the business class, and his intellectual immersion in the work of similarly conditioned intellectuals. But all this ideology, however strongly held, really did not much harm to his scientific achievement in producing sound, factual, and analytic teaching. Similarly with Karl Marx, whose ideological vision of social processes was formed before he began to study economics, but as his analytic work matured, Marx not only elaborated many pieces of scientific analysis that were neutral to that vision, but also some that did not agree with it well, even though Marx continued to use vituperative phraseology that does not affect the scientific elements in an argument. Ironically, Marx's view of businessmen was not quite as totally negative as that of Adam Smith. According to Schumpeter, in itself, scientific performance does not require us to divest ourselves of our value judgments or to renounce the calling of an advocate of some particular interest. More bluntly, he said, advocacy does not imply lying, though sometimes ideologies crystallize into creeds that are impervious to argument. But among the hallmarks of a scientific field are rules of procedure which can crush out ideologically conditioned error from an analysis. Moreover, having something to formulate, to defend, to attack, provides an impetus for factual and analytical work, even if ideology sometimes interferes with it. Therefore, though we proceed slowly because of our ideologies, we might not proceed at all without them. Events and ideas. Does economics influence events, and do events influence economics? The short answer to both questions is yes, but the only meaningful question is, to what extent and in what particular ways? John Maynard Keynes' answer to the first question was this. The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. Madmen in authority who hear voices in the air are distilling their frenzy from some academic scribbler of a few years back. I am sure that the power of vested interests is vastly exaggerated compared with the gradual encroachment of ideas. In other words, it was not by direct influence over those who hold power at a particular point in time that economists influence the course of events, according to Keynes. It was by generating certain general beliefs and attitudes which provide the context within which opinion makers think and politicians act. In that sense, the mercantilists are still an influence on beliefs and attitudes in the world today, centuries after they were refuted decisively within the economics profession by Adam Smith. The question whether economics is shaped by events is more controversial. At one time, it was widely believed that ideas are shaped by surrounding circumstances and events, and that economic ideas were no exception. No doubt something in the real world starts people thinking about economic ideas, as is no doubt true of ideas in other fields, including science and mathematics. Trigonometry has been thought to have been given an impetus by a need to resurvey land in Egypt after recurring floods along the Nile wiped out boundaries between different people's properties in ancient times. That is one kind of influence. A more immediate and direct influence has been assumed by those who believed that the Great Depression of the 1930s spawned Keynesian economics. But even if the Great Depression inspired Keynes' thinking and the widespread acceptance of that thinking among economists around the world, how typical was that of the way that economics has evolved historically, much less how ideas in other fields have evolved historically? Were more things falling down, or was their falling creating more social problems when Newton developed his theory of gravity? Certainly, there were not more free markets when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, which advocated freer markets precisely because of his dissatisfaction with the effects of various kinds of government intervention that were pervasive at the time. The great shift within 19th-century economics from a theory of price determined by production costs to a theory of price determined by consumer demand was not in response to changes in either production costs or consumer demand. It was simply the unpredictable emergence of a new intellectual insight as a way of resolving ambiguities and inconsistencies in existing economic theory. As for depressions, there had been depressions before the 1930s, without producing a Keynes. Nobel Prize-winning economist George Stigler pointed out that momentous events in the real world may have no intellectual consequences. A war may ravage a continent or destroy a generation without posing new theoretical questions, he said. The tragic reality is that wars have spread ruination and devastation across continents many times over the centuries, so that there need be no new issue to confront intellectually, even in the midst of an overwhelming catastrophe. Whatever its origins or its ability to influence or be influenced by external events, economics is ultimately a study of an enduring part of the human condition. Its value depends on its contribution to our understanding of a particular set of conditions involving the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Unfortunately, little of the knowledge and understanding within the economics profession has reached the average citizen and voter, leaving politicians free to do things that would never be tolerated if most people understood economics as well as Alfred Marshall understood it a century ago, or David Ricardo 2 centuries ago. Political issues. Ivan and Boris and us. There is an old Russian fable, with different versions in other countries, about two poor peasants, Ivan and Boris. The only difference between them was that Boris had a goat and Ivan didn't. One day, Ivan came upon a strange-looking lamp, and when he rubbed it, a genie appeared. She told him that she could grant him just one wish, but it could be anything in the world. Ivan said, "I want Boris's goat to die." Variations on this story in other countries suggest that this tells us something about human beings, not just Russians. It may tell us something painful about many Americans today, when so many people are preoccupied with the pay of corporate CEOs. It is not that the corporate CEO's pay affects them so much. If every oil company executive in America agreed to work for nothing, that would not be enough to lower the price of a gallon of gasoline by a dime. If every General Motors executive agreed to work for nothing, that would not lower the price of a Cadillac or a Chevrolet by 1%. Too many people are like Ivan, who wanted Boris's goat to die. It is not even that the average corporate CEO makes as much money as any number of professional athletes and entertainers. The average pay of a CEO of a corporation big enough to be included in the Standard & Poor's Index is less than one-third of what Alex Rodriguez makes, about one-tenth of what Tiger Woods makes, and less than one-thirtieth of what Oprah Winfrey makes. But when has anyone ever accused athletes or entertainers of greed? It is not the general public that singles out corporate CEOs for so much attention. Politicians and the media have focused on business leaders, and the public has been led along like sheep. The logic is simple. Demonize those whose place or power you plan to usurp. Politicians who want the power to micromanage business and the economy know that demonizing those who currently run businesses is the opening salvo in the battle to take over their roles. There is no way that politicians can take over the roles of Alex Rodriguez, Tiger Woods, or Oprah Winfrey, so they can make any amount of money they want, and it doesn't matter politically. Those who want more power have known for centuries that giving the people somebody to hate and fear is the key. In 18th century France, promoting hatred of the aristocracy was the key to Robespierre's acquiring more dictatorial power than the aristocracy had ever had, and using that power to create a bigger bloodbath than anything under the old regime. In the 20th century, it was both the czars and the capitalists in Russia who were made the targets of public hatred by the communists on their road to power. That power created more havoc in the lives of more people than czars and capitalists ever had combined. As in other countries and other times, today it is not just a question of which elites win out in a tug of war in America. It is the people at large who have the most at stake. We have just seen one of the biggest free home demonstrations of what happens in an economy when politicians tell businesses what decisions to make. For years, using the powers of the Community Reinvestment Act and other regulatory powers, along with threats of legal action if the loan approval rates varied from the population profile, politicians have pressured banks and other lending institutions into lending to people they would not lend to otherwise. Yet, when all this blows up in our faces and the economy turns down, what is the answer? To have more economic decisions made by politicians, because they choose to say that deregulation is the cause of our problems. Regardless of how much suffocating regulation may have been responsible for an economic debacle, politicians have learned that they can get away with it if they call it deregulation. No matter what happens, for politicians it is heads I win and tails you lose. If we keep listening to the politicians and their media allies, we are all going to keep losing, big time. Keeping our attention focused on CEO pay, Boris's goat, is all part of this game. We are all goats if we fall for it. Ronald Reagan, 1911 to 2004. There are many ways to judge a president or anyone else. One old-fashioned way is by results. A more popular way in recent years has been by how well someone fits the preconceptions of the intelligentsia or the media. By the first test, Ronald Reagan was the most successful president of the United States in the 20th century. By the second test, he was a complete failure. Time and time again, President Reagan went against what the smug smarties inside the Beltway and on the TV tube said, and time and again, he got results. It started even before Ronald Reagan was elected. When the Republicans nominated Governor Reagan in 1980, according to the late Washington Post editor Meg Greenfield, people I knew in the Carter White House were ecstatic. They considered Reagan not nearly smart enough, as liberals measure smart. The fact that Ronald Reagan beat President Jimmy Carter by a landslide did not cause any reevaluation of his intelligence. It was luck or malaise or something else, liberals thought. Now the media line was that this cowboy from California would be taught a lesson when he got to Washington and had to play in the big leagues against the savvy guys on Capitol Hill. The new president succeeded in putting through Congress big changes that were called the Reagan Revolution. And he did it without ever having his party in control of both houses of Congress. But these results caused no reevaluation of Ronald Reagan. One of his first acts as president was to end price controls on petroleum. The New York Times condescendingly dismissed Reagan's reliance on the free market and repeated widespread predictions of declining domestic oil production and skyrocketing gasoline prices. The price of gasoline fell by more than 60 cents a gallon. More luck, apparently. Where the new president would really get his comeuppance, the smart money said, was in foreign affairs, where a former governor had no experience. Not only were President Reagan's ideas about foreign policy considered naive and dangerously reckless, he would be going up against the wily Soviet rulers, who were old hands at this stuff. When Ronald Reagan referred to the Soviet Union as an evil empire, there were howls of disapproval in the media. When he proposed meeting a Soviet nuclear buildup in Eastern Europe with an American nuclear buildup in Western Europe, there were alarms that he was going to get us into a war. The result? President Reagan's policies not only did not get us into a war, they put an end to the Cold War that had been going on for decades. Meanwhile, Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the media's idea of a brilliant and sophisticated man, had a whole communist empire collapse under him when his policies were put into effect. Eastern Europe broke free, and Gorbachev woke up one morning to find that the Soviet Union that he was head of no longer existed, and that he was now a nobody in the new Russian state. But that was just bad luck, apparently. For decades, it had been considered the height of political wisdom to accept as given that the Soviet bloc was here to stay, and its expansion was so inevitable that it would be foolhardy to try to stop it. The Soviet bloc had in fact expanded through 7 consecutive administrations of both Republicans and Democrats. The first territory the communists ever lost was Grenada, when Ronald Reagan sent in American troops. But once again, results carried no weight with the intelligentsia and the media. Reagan was considered to be completely out of touch when he said that communism was another sad, bizarre chapter in human history whose last pages even now are being written. But how many smart people saw the end of the Soviet Union coming? Ronald Reagan left this country and the world a far better place than he found it, and he smiled while he did it. That's greatness, if you judge by results. The Compassion Racket. Our hearts automatically go out to the people of Florida, who are being battered by a series of hurricanes in rapid succession. But we have brains as well as hearts, and the time is long overdue to start using them. Hurricanes come through Florida every year about this time, and every year politicians get to parade their compassion by showering the taxpayers' money on the places that have been struck. What would happen if they didn't? First of all, not as many people would build homes in the path of a well-known disaster that comes around like clockwork virtually every year. Those who did would buy insurance that covers the costs of the risks they choose to take. That insurance would not be cheap, which would provide yet another reason for people to locate out of harm's way. The net result would be fewer lives lost and less property damage. Is it not more compassionate to seek this result, even if it would deprive politicians of television time? In ABC reporter John Stossel's witty and insightful book, Give Me a Break, he discusses how he built a beach house with only a few hundred feet of sand between him and the ocean. It gave him a great view and a great chance of disaster. His father warned him of the danger, but an architect pointed out that the government would pick up the tab if anything happened to his house. A few years later, storm-driven ocean waves came in and flooded the ground floor of Stossel's home. The government paid to have it restored. Still later, the waves came in again, and this time took out the whole house. The government paid again. Fortunately for the taxpayers, Stossel then decided that enough was enough. In politics, throwing the taxpayers' money at disasters is supposed to show your compassion. But robbing Peter to pay Paul is not compassion. It is politics. The crucial fact is that a society does not have one dime more money to devote to the resources available to help victims of natural disasters by sending that money through government agencies. All that it does is change the incentives in such a way as to subsidize risky behavior. The same money can just as well come through insurance companies. Even if most insurance companies are unwilling to insure people living in particularly vulnerable areas or living in homes that are inadequate to withstand hurricane-force winds, there are always insurers who specialize in high risks and who charge correspondingly higher premiums. Lloyd's of London, for example, has already been moving into the market for insurance for homes costing $500,000 or more and located along coastal waters, whether in Florida or the Hamptons or elsewhere. If rich people want to put their mansions at risk, there is no reason why they shouldn't pay the costs, instead of forcing the taxpayers to pay those costs. What about the poor? As in so many other cases, the poor are the human shields behind which big government advocates advance. If you are seriously concerned about the poor themselves, you can always subsidize them and avoid subsidizing others by having means tests. Means tests are anathema to the political left because that puts an end to their game of hiding behind the poor. Compassion is a laudable feeling, but it can also be a political racket. As with so many government programs that people have come to rely on, phasing out state and federal disaster relief programs would not be easy. In an election year, it is impossible. Fortunately, there are years in between elections in which it is at least theoretically possible to talk sense. Whether the risks are hurricanes, earthquakes, floods, or forest fires, people who have gotten themselves out on a limb by taking risks in the expectation that the government will bail them out can be gradually weaned away from that expectation by phasing out disaster relief. The alternative is to keep on forcing taxpayers to be patsies forever, while politicians bask in the glow of the compassion racket by throwing the taxpayers' money hither and yon, while the media applaud the courage of those who rebuild in the path of known disasters. Spoiled brat politics. An editorial in a recent issue of the National Geographic's Traveler magazine complained that kayakers in Maine found residential development near national parks and urged its readers to use their influence to prevent such things. "You are the stakeholders in our national parks," it said. Really? What stake do kayakers and others of like mind have that is not also a stake held by people who build the vacation homes whose presence offends the kayak set? Homeowners are just as much citizens and taxpayers as kayakers are, and they are even entitled to equal treatment under the 14th Amendment. The essence of bigotry is denying others the same rights you claim for yourself. Green bigots are a classic example. The idea that government is supposed to make your desires override the desires of other citizens has spread from the green bigots to other groups who claim privileges in the name of rights. In California, a group of golfers in wheelchairs are suing a hotel chain for not providing them with special carts that will enable them to navigate the local hotel's golf course more comfortably and play the game better. According to a newspaper account, the kinds of carts the golfers in wheelchairs want have rotating seats so a golfer can swing and strike a ball from the tee, the fairway, and on the green without getting out of the vehicle. If golfers want this kind of cart, there is nothing to stop them from buying one, except that they would rather have other people be forced to pay for it. One of the golfers in this lawsuit has been confined to a wheelchair as a result of a diving accident and another as a result of a gunshot wound. Apparently, the hotel had nothing to do with either event. There was a time when people would have said that the hotel is not responsible for these golfers being in wheelchairs, and therefore it has no obligation to spend additional money for special carts in order to help their scores on the links. But that was before the Americans with Disabilities Act, under which the hotel is being sued. If the government wanted to do something for the disabled or the handicapped, it could have spent its own tax money to do so. Instead, it passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, which created a right to sue private institutions in order to force them to spend their money to solve the problems of individuals with special problems or special desires, whether serious or frivolous. It was a Lawyers' Full Employment Act, creating another legally recognized victim group empowered to claim special privileges at other people's expense in the name of equal rights. Nor could such legislation make the usual claim that it was coming to the defense of the poor and the downtrodden. Golf courses are not the natural habitat of the poor and the downtrodden. One of the plaintiffs in the golf course lawsuit has been the managing partner in a large law firm. He says, "I just want the same opportunity as everyone else to get out and play 18 holes with my friends and colleagues." Equal opportunity does not mean equal results, despite how many laws and policies proceed as if it does, or how much fashionable rhetoric equates the two. An example of that rhetoric was the title of a recent New York Times column, "A Ticket to Bias." That column recalled bitterly the experience of a woman in a wheelchair who bought a $300 ticket to a rock concert but was unable to see when other people around her stood up. This was equated with bias on the part of those who ran the arena. The woman in the wheelchair declared, "True equality remains a dream out of reach." Apparently, only equality of results is true equality. A recent publication of the American Historical Association shows this same confusion when it says that doors are largely closed to people who want to become historians if they didn't graduate from a top-tier college. In other words, unequal results proves bias that closed doors, according to this rhetoric. Confusion between equal opportunity and equal results is a dangerous confusion behind many kinds of spoiled brat politics. The Left's Vocabulary. A recent angry email from a reader said that certain issues should not be determined by the dictates of the market. With a mere turn of a phrase, he had turned reality upside down. Decisions by people free to make their mutual accommodations with other free people were called dictates, while having third parties tell all of them what they could and couldn't do was not. Verbal coups have long been a specialty of the left. Totalitarian countries on the left have called themselves people's democracies and used the egalitarian greeting comrade, even though some comrades had the arbitrary power of life and death over other comrades. In democratic countries, where public opinion matters, the left has used its verbal talents to change the whole meaning of words and to substitute new words, so that issues would be debated in terms of their redefined vocabulary instead of the real substance of the issues. Words which have acquired connotations from the actual experiences of millions of human beings over generations or even centuries have been replaced by new words that wipe out those connotations and substitute more fashionable notions of the left. The word swamp, for example, has been all but erased from the language. Swamps were messy, sometimes smelly places where mosquitoes bred and sometimes snakes lurked. The left has replaced the word swamp with wetlands, a word spoken in pious tones, usually reserved for sacred things. The point of this verbal sleight of hand is to impose the left's notions of how other people can use their own land. Restrictive laws about wetlands have imposed huge costs on farmers and other owners of land that happen to have a certain amount of water on it. Another word that the left has virtually banished from the language is bum. Centuries of experience with idlers who refused to work and who hung around on the streets making a nuisance and sometimes a menace of themselves were erased from our memories as the left verbally transformed those same people into a sacred icon, the homeless. As with swamps, what was once messy and smelly was now turned into something we had a duty to protect. It was now our duty to support people who refused to support themselves. Crimes committed by bums are covered up by the media by verbally transforming the homeless into transients or drifters whenever they commit crimes. Thus, the homeless are the only group you never hear of committing any crimes. More to the point, third parties' notions are imposed by the power of the government to raise our taxes to support people who are raising hell on our streets and in parks where it has often become too dangerous for our children to play. The left has a whole vocabulary devoted to depicting people who do not meet standards as people who have been denied access. Whether it is academic standards, job qualifications, or credit requirements, those who do not measure up are said to have been deprived of opportunity, rights, or social justice. The word games of the left, from the mantra of diversity to the pieties of compassion, are not just games. They are ways of imposing power by evading issues of substance through the use of seductive rhetoric. Rights, for example, have become an all-purpose term used for evading both facts and logic by saying that people have a right to whatever the left wants to give them by taking from others. For centuries, rights were exemptions from government power, as in the Bill of Rights. Now, the left has redefined rights as things that can be demanded from the taxpayers or from private employers or others on behalf of people who accept no mutual obligations, even for common decency. At one time, educators tried to teach students to carefully define words and systematically analyze arguments. They said, "We are here to teach you how to think, not what to think." Today, they are teaching students what to think. Political correctness. Instead of knowledge, students are given self-esteem so that they can vent their ignorance with confidence. Unfunded mandates. Nothing so epitomizes contemporary liberalism as unfunded mandates, in which the federal government establishes programs and forces the states to pay for them. The very need to weigh benefits against costs, the essence of economics, is evaded by this irresponsible exercise of arrogance. It is like impulse buying and charging it to somebody else's credit card. The great hysteria in the media about the wonderful programs that will be lost if unfunded mandates are stopped misses the whole point. If these programs are as wonderful as they are said to be, then they should be paid for. Nothing is easier than to make a verbal case for almost anything, but are you willing to put your money where your mouth is? If you are not even willing to put the taxpayers' money where your mouth is, there is something wrong somewhere. The number of things that are beneficial vastly exceeds what any nation can afford. That is why both individuals and organizations must weigh trade-offs all the time. Unfunded mandates, hidden taxes, and a whole range of environmental restrictions are all ways of making costly decisions without having to weigh those costs against the benefits. It is government by magic words, whether those words are safety, minimum wages, or clean air. Can anybody be against safety? Not verbally and not politically. But in real life, do we go around in suits of armor? Do we refuse to drive or ride in cars? Of course not. We weigh the risks against the benefits. Only in grandiloquent political rhetoric do we claim that safety must be achieved at all costs. We can do it there only because those costs are to be paid by somebody else. When even the big spenders in Washington are not willing to pay from the federal treasury, then we have lost all sense of trade-offs. We have become like small children who want everything and cry if we don't get it. What is the minimum wage law but an unfunded mandate imposed on private organizations? If everyone deserves a living wage or a decent standard of living, then why don't those who think that way supply these things? If it is society's responsibility to see that no one falls below some economic level, then why don't we raise the taxes and pay for that level? Why is someone who runs a print shop or a bakery more responsible for other people's economic level than someone who works in 1,000 other occupations? TV pundits and editorial office saints often make more money than the great majority of businessmen. Why single out employers to dump this responsibility on? We all want clean air and water, don't we? The only problem is that there has never been any such thing. No water and no air has ever been 100% pure, at least not since Adam and Eve made the wrong decision back in the garden. There are different levels of impurities with different levels of consequences. No one wants to breathe air full of sulfur or drink water with sewage in it, so it makes sense to remove some impurities, but not every trace of everything that every hysterical crusader can think of. There are wells being shut down by the government because they have traces of chemicals more minute than you can find in a bottle of soda or a can of beer. Any one of us could make the air in his own home cleaner by installing all sorts of costly filters, and we could eliminate many impurities in water by drinking only water that we distilled ourselves. But we don't do that, do we? We think it is too costly, whether in money or in time. Only when we are putting costs on other people do we go hog wild like that. Making us pay is one way to make us think. Environmental agencies have been having a field day putting restrictions on how other people can use their own property. These restrictions may cut the value of the property in half, or even reduce it to zero. There is never a lack of pretty words to justify this. But what if those agencies had to compensate the owner for the losses they have imposed on him? If the restrictions' benefit to society outweigh the losses to the owner, then it makes sense to pay the money and everybody ends up better off. But when you confiscate property by the back door, you can just say some lofty words and keep going. You don't have to weigh anything against anything. In reality, many of the things being financed by unfunded mandates or imposed on businesses and property owners are not for the benefit of society. They are for the benefit of the careers or the egos of those who promote programs. That is why things that cannot be justified have to be financed under the table. Reflections on term limits. The reflecting pool between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial may be the only thing in Washington that is reflecting. Preoccupation with the never-ending task of political fundraising, fighting daily brush fires, and trying to put the right spin on the crisis du jour leaves very little time for the nation's political leaders to step back and contemplate deeper and enduring questions amid the swirl of events and rhetoric. Reflection is not a luxury, but a prime necessity. Anyone who has ever done anything as mundane as looking for a house knows how much time and thought goes into weighing one place against another and both against the bank account, not to mention the conflicting demands of getting to work, getting the children in a good school, and many other considerations. Imagine if in 1 year you had to decide and vote on complex environmental issues, foreign policy around the world, racial issues at home, military defense, judicial appointments, and regulating public utilities, pharmaceutical drugs, the stock market, and the safety of mines, airports, food, and vaccines. Even if we arbitrarily assume that none of these things is any more complicated than buying a house, how many people could handle all the problems of buying a house 10 times in 1 year? Worse yet, these national and international issues are not the sole or even the main business of those in Congress or the White House. Their main business is getting reelected. That is also the main business of those who work for them, even though theoretically these staffers and appointees work for the country and certainly are paid by the taxpayers. One of the strongest cases for term limits is that a one-term rule would free up a major block of time and eliminate a major conflict of interest among elected officials and their staffs by eliminating their overwhelming preoccupation with getting reelected. Those advocates of term limits who wish merely to restrict the number of terms forfeit much of this advantage, for, if 3 terms are allowed for a congressman, then in 2/3 of those terms, the congressman and his staff will still be preoccupied with reelection. If the fear is that 2 years is too short a time for a member of the House of Representatives to get the lay of the land and become an effective legislator, then instead of allowing 3 2-year terms, 1 6-year term could be established. The point is to get people focused on national concerns, not their own reelection. Those who fear that we would lose the great expertise that members of Congress develop after years of dealing with certain issues fail to see that much of that expertise is in the arts of packaging, log rolling, creative accounting, and other forms of deception. Those who dominate the national political scene, and often the local scene as well, are experts only in the law and in political machinations. Genuine experts in particular fields seldom have either the incentive or the political talents to get elected to public office. A leading surgeon, engineer, corporate executive, scientist, or financial consultant earns far more than the salary of any public official in Washington. What incentive is there for someone like this to sacrifice his family's present well-being and future security unless he is so driven by the desire for power that any sacrifice seems worth it? Anyone with such a craving for power is the last person to trust with power. One of the greatest economic moves we could make would be to pay every member of Congress $1 million a year, but with no perks and no pension. Paying this salary to each member of Congress for the entire 21st century would cost less than running the Department of Agriculture for 1 year. This would pay for itself many times over, because many government agencies and programs could be eliminated by a Congress not concerned with raising campaign money from special interests that benefit from bureaucracies ostensibly set up to serve the public. With such a salary, people who are at the top of many fields could afford to spend 1 term in Washington performing a civic duty without sacrificing their families, and without any prospect that this could be a career from which they could retire with a pension. The absence of perks would emphasize that they were not little tin gods, but simply citizens temporarily serving in government. They could also bring some real expertise to Washington, expertise in something besides politics. The survival of the left. Biologists explain how organisms adapt to their physical environment, but ideologues also adapt to their social environment. The most fundamental fact about the ideals of the political left is that they do not work. Therefore, we should not be surprised to find the left concentrated in institutions where ideas do not have to work in order to survive. The academic world is the natural habitat of half-baked ideas, except for those fields in which there are decisive tests, such as science, mathematics, engineering, medicine, and athletics. In all these fields, in their differing ways, there comes a time when you must either put up or shut up. It should not be surprising that all of these fields are notable exceptions to the complete domination of the left on campuses across the country. In the humanities, for example, the test of deconstructionism is not whether it can produce any tangible results, but whether it remains in vogue. So long as it does, professors skilled in its verbal sleight of hand can expect to continue to receive 6-figure salaries. You might think that the collapse of communism throughout Eastern Europe would be considered a decisive failure for Marxism, but academic Marxists in America are utterly undaunted. Their paychecks and their tenure are unaffected. Their theories continue to flourish in the classrooms, and their journals continue to litter the library shelves. Socialism in general has a record of failure so blatant that only an intellectual could ignore or evade it. Even countries that were once more prosperous than their neighbors have found themselves much poorer than their neighbors after just 1 generation of socialistic policies. Whether these neighboring countries were Ghana and the Ivory Coast, or Burma and Thailand, it has been the same story around the world. Nor is economic failure the worst of it. the millions slaughtered by Stalin, Mao, and Pol Pot for political reasons are an even grimmer reality. People who live and work in a world where there is a business bottom line, an athletic scoreboard, a military battlefield, or life-and-death surgery may find it hard to fully appreciate the difference between that kind of world and one in which the only decisive test is whether your colleagues like what you are saying. Academia is only one of the places where wholly subjective criteria rule and where leftists predominate. Endowed institutions, such as foundations and museums, likewise often face no test other than what like-minded people find exciting and what enables those who run these institutions to get the heady feeling that they are making a difference. The same is true of cultural institutions supported involuntarily by the taxpayers, such as the Smithsonian or the National Endowments for the Arts and the Humanities. Taxpayer-supported public radio and television are similarly insulated from reality and similarly dominated by the left, not only in the United States, but in other countries as well. All the nostrums of the left that have brought hunger to millions in countries which used to have surplus food to export, all the pretty words and ugly realities that have caused millions more to flee the lands of their birth, these nostrums live on in public television, much like old classic movies with familiar lines that the audience of aficionados can recite along with the characters on the screen. These endowed and insulated institutions, often full of contempt for the values of American society and Western civilization, are not the only bastions of the left counterculture. So are Hollywood and Broadway. Although showbiz faces the financial need to get an audience, the truth of what they portray is hardly crucial. If they can make it punchy and sexy, then those who complain about historical inaccuracies and ideological bias can be dismissed as irrelevant pedants. Why are leftists able to crowd out other kinds of people from these places? Because those who are willing to subject themselves to the test of reality, whether as a businessman in the marketplace or as a surgeon in an operating room, have many other places in which to work and live. They do not need special sheltered niches in which to hide and to cherish their precious notions. Darwinian adaptation to environment applies not only to nature, but also to society. Just as you don't find eagles living in the ocean or fish living on mountaintops, so you don't find leftists concentrated where their ideas have to stand the test of performance. Politics in One Lesson. Henry Hazlitt wrote a book called Economics in One Lesson. Charles Murray's book, What It Means to Be a Libertarian, could have been titled Politics in One Lesson. Unlike The Bell Curve, which Murray co-authored, this book has no footnotes, only a couple of very simple diagrams, and is a slender volume written in an easy essay style. Seldom has so much substance and wisdom been packed into so few words, demonstrating in the process that the case against the welfare state and the regulatory state is very straightforward. Those who oppose Murray's conclusions will undoubtedly consider them simplistic, since elaborate and even convoluted arguments are considered signs of sophistication, rather than desperate expedients to try to salvage a position contrary to plain facts and plain logic. Murray begins by running through the main functions of government that he would reduce or eliminate. He would eliminate entirely all government regulation of products and services, leaving tort law to deal with harms caused by defective products in normal use. Indeed, the requirement that product liability be restricted to harms caused in normal use would itself be a revolutionary rollback in existing tort law, in which the consumer's own dangerous behavior does not prevent the manufacturer from being held liable for the bad consequences. Among the federal cabinet-level departments to be destroyed entirely, in this libertarian vision, are the departments of agriculture, commerce, energy, transportation, and housing and urban development. Among the programs to be ended would be Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, antitrust actions, welfare, aerospace exploration, and all regulation of terms and conditions of employment, including civil rights laws. You might think that such a sweeping agenda would require a huge book to justify the slaughter of so many sacred cows, but in fact, the political justifications for these huge governmental activities are remarkably vulnerable, as Murray demonstrates by puncturing them with a few well-placed thrusts. For all his uncompromising libertarianism, Murray rejects the atomistic vision of some libertarian intellectuals, as he also rejects the popular me-generation attitudes of self-fulfillment that gave short shrift to parenting and neighboring. Indeed, one of his strongest objections to the welfare state is that it turned over to government bureaucracies a large portion of the responsibility for feeding the hungry, succoring the sick, comforting the sad, nurturing the children, tending the elderly, and chastising the sinners. In short, many of the things that liberals say should be done by society, Murray agrees should be done in society, but not by government. Murray wants humanitarian acts done at the individual level, and in ways that do not induce dependency or deprive people of personal responsibility by writing federal blank checks to subsidize antisocial and self-destructive behavior. One of the major contributions of this book is exposing the fallacy of government agencies that use statistical before and after comparisons to claim success in their activities. Often, the benefits claimed are part of a trend that began long before the program in question began, and the slope of the trend line was not visibly changed afterwards. Thus, the steepest drop in poverty occurred during the 1950s, before the war on poverty began. Yet all further continuation of this trend is automatically credited to government social programs that began in the 1960s. It is much the same story when one plots the trend of increasing black representation in the professions. Murray finds that the steepest slope of the trend line occurs in the early 1960s, before even the original Civil Rights Act of 1964. It is much the same story with statistical trends after legislation on health, education, safety, and labor. The decades-long downward trend in automobile fatality rates leveled off after the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit was imposed, and test scores actually declined after massive federal spending on education. Murray freely admits that his proposals, which would cut government by more than half, are not at all politically feasible today, or perhaps even within his lifetime. But of course, the whole point of writing such a book is to begin the process of changing people's minds. Most of the New Deal would have been politically impossible just 5 years before Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected. The Pattern of the Anointed. They went to work with unsurpassable efficiency, full employment, a maximum of resulting output, and general well-being ought to have been the consequence. It is true that instead we find misery, shame, and, at the end of it all, a stream of blood. But that was a chance coincidence. Joseph A. Schumpeter. What is intellectually interesting about visions are their assumptions and their reasoning, but what is socially crucial is the extent to which they are resistant to evidence. All social theories being imperfect, the harm done by their imperfections depends not only on how far they differ from reality, but also on how readily they adjust to evidence to come back into line with the facts. One theory may be more plausible or even more sound than another, but if it is also more dogmatic, then that can make it far more dangerous than a theory that is not initially as close to the truth, but which is more capable of adjusting to feedback from the real world. The prevailing vision of our time, the vision of the anointed, has shown an extraordinary ability to defy evidence. Characteristic patterns have developed among the anointed for dealing with the repeated failures of policies based on their vision. Other patterns have developed for seizing upon statistics in such a way as to buttress the assumptions of the vision, even when the same set of statistics contain numbers that contradict the vision. Finally, there is the phenomenon of honored prophets among the anointed, who continue to be honored as their predictions fail by vast margins time and again. Patterns of Failure. A very distinct pattern has emerged repeatedly when policies favored by the anointed turn out to fail. This pattern typically has four stages. Stage 1, the crisis. Some situation exists whose negative aspects the anointed propose to eliminate. Such a situation is routinely characterized as a crisis. Even though all human situations have negative aspects, and even though evidence is seldom asked or given to show how the situation at hand is either uniquely bad or threatening to get worse, sometimes the situation described as a crisis has in fact already been getting better for years. Stage 2, the solution. Policies to end the crisis are advocated by the anointed, who say that these policies will lead to beneficial result A. Critics say that these policies will lead to detrimental result Z. The anointed dismiss these latter claims as absurd and simplistic, if not dishonest. Stage 3, the results. The policies are instituted and lead to detrimental result Z. Stage 4, the response. Those who attribute detrimental result Z to the policies instituted are dismissed as simplistic for ignoring the complexities involved, as many factors went into determining the outcome. The burden of proof is put on the critics to demonstrate to a certainty that these policies alone were the only possible cause of the worsening that occurred. No burden of proof whatever is put on those who had so confidently predicted improvement. Indeed, it is often asserted that things would have been even worse were it not for the wonderful programs that mitigated the inevitable damage from other factors. Examples of this pattern are all too abundant. Three will be considered here. The first and most general involves the set of social welfare policies called the War on Poverty, during the administration of President Lyndon B. Johnson, but continuing under other labels since then. Next is the policy of introducing sex education into the public schools as a means of reducing teenage pregnancy and venereal diseases. The third example will be policies designed to reduce crime by adopting a less punitive approach, being more concerned with preventive social policies beforehand and rehabilitation afterwards, as well as showing more concern with the legal rights of defendants in criminal cases. The War on Poverty. Governmental policies designed to alleviate the privations of the poor go back much further than President Johnson's War on Poverty, and of course reach far beyond the boundaries of the United States. What was different about this particular set of social programs, first proposed to Congress during the Kennedy administration and later enacted into law during the Johnson administration, was that their stated purpose was a reduction of dependency, not simply the provision of more material goods to the poor. This was the recurring theme of the War on Poverty from the time President Kennedy introduced this legislation in 1962 until President Johnson saw it passed and signed into law in 1964. John F. Kennedy stated the purpose of the War on Poverty would be to help our less fortunate citizens to help themselves. He said, "We must find ways of returning far more of our dependent people to independence." The whole point of currently increased federal spending on this effort was to strengthen and broaden the rehabilitative and preventive services offered to persons who are dependent or who would otherwise become dependent.